This is Citizens Climate Radio. In this show, we highlight people's stories. We celebrate your successes. And together, we share strategies for talking about climate change. I'm your host, Peter Santoscano. Welcome to episode 21 of Citizens Climate Radio, a project of Citizens Climate Education. This episode is airing on Saturday, February 24th, 2018. Our main topic today covers a huge issue. So big, in fact, it will take up most of our time. Don't worry, next month I will give you an extended art house interview with writer Claire Vey Watkins. She wrote the incredibly powerful cli-fi novel Gold Fame Citrus. It's a wild book about a giant desert that takes over much of the western USA. Look for it next month. But today, we're traveling to Cape Town, South Africa. What is happening there right now sounds like climate fiction. The blockbuster makers in Hollywood couldn't dream this stuff up.
We are one of the most visible, beautiful, striking, and historically interesting and infamous cities in the world, and we're about to run out of water. Our dams are about to run dry. There will be nothing left to come out of our taps.
That's Helen Moffat, a Capetonian. She is here to tell us about Day Zero. Right? It sounds like one of those movies.
1.5 million tourists flood into a city of 4 million every single year, and we're about to run out of water. Our dams are empty. There's very little we can do about that. In the grips of an unprecedented drought, everybody's calling it the 100-year drought and saying that we couldn't possibly have seen this coming. But actually, every single climate change scientist did see it coming. What's happening is that we are facing something called Day Zero. That is the day when the municipalities of Cape Town will have to switch off the water, because what little water is left in the dams will no longer be potable or treatable to be potable. Plus, they have to keep a certain trickle open for emergency services, for institutions like hospitals. There's talk of leaving the central business district of Cape Town open for water business.
The exact date of Day Zero is still to be determined. Because of the extraordinary responses to water conservation and some possibly projected rainfall, Day Zero has been moved from mid-April to early July. But it is wild. A major city running out of water?
Okay. Now, obviously, your listeners will all know that we're not the first major city to run out of water in the world. That privilege belongs to Sao Paulo. And then we're not even the first South African city to run out of water. That privilege belongs to a city most people haven't even heard of, certainly not overseas. And that's a huge city called Putatichaba, up on the Lesotho Free State border.
That's right. São Paulo, a city of 20 million people, has faced water cuts starting in 2015 because of a drought and overpopulation. And then in Mexico City, there's the district of Iztapalapa. The citizens there do not have running water for months at a time. This results in tension and violence. I admit I never heard of the South African city of Putatichaba or their water crisis.
Putatichaba, a huge semi-rural city up in the highlands of the country, nestled on the slopes of the Drakensberg on the Lesotho border, ran out of water 18 months ago, and it barely made a blip in the South African media. Nobody noticed and nobody cared. Putatichaba is a relatively small city. They could send in the water tankers, which, by the way, is what they did, how they handled the crisis. They sent around water tankers, and everybody just queued up water tankers. We're too big, and we have far too much business. When a city or a region produces 10% of the country's GDP and it runs out of water, I think everybody sits up and pays attention.
Helen Moffat has a lot to say about this crisis and is wonderfully expressive in how she speaks about it. She is a freelance writer who has covered topics ranging from the sport of cricket to erotic literature. Helen is a lifelong activist. Her childhood has prepared her for this moment in South African history.
I have been an activist for just about as long as I can remember, decades and decades now, not just in the struggle against apartheid, but as a feminist activist, my work, especially on gender-based violence, is ongoing. I've had sort of formal and informal affiliations with Rape Crisis Cape Town, which is now the oldest rape crisis organization in the world still in existence. So I've been an activist for women's rights. My mother says since I was 10 years old, but I don't remember it going quite that far back. And then I've always been an enthusiastic environmental activist simply because of the way I was brought up. My father is an environmental botanist and an academic, and my mother is an environmental gardener, by which I mean that decades before it was fashionable to do so, she would garden using only organic principles. She would landscape any soil or earth or plot that she worked with so that she maximized water soak, water runoff, water flow, so as to create, be able to create water-wise forests, basically, or water-resilient forests.
Doing that sort of thing in the 1970s was pretty progressive for most people in North America and the UK. In South Africa, it was light years ahead of the time.
Most Americans are familiar with the struggle against apartheid, especially if they're liberal. But what very few people realize is that living under apartheid didn't just mean living under a system of racial prejudice and segregation. It was like living in the past, full stop. At any given moment, you felt as if you'd sort of parachuted down somewhere into about 1937. We were a homophobic culture. We were an anti-Semitic culture. Women had precious few rights, and the only women who did have rights were white women, but not even they were recognized as full adults until the late 90s. So, of course, environmental issues were always sort of fringe. They took place on the edges of the universities and various research centers and think tanks, and there was always a sort of a hippie lentil fringe.
A hippie lentil fringe. Oh, I like that. So Helen is prepared to conserve water. Good thing, too. The city rolled out an emergency water plan to ration water in hopes of delaying day zero. Once the taps go off, each resident will have to queue at water stations for their daily allotment of 25 liters. That's 6 U.S. gallons of water per day for everything. Drinking, washing, cooking, oh, and flushing the toilet.
And this will go on until such time as that there is enough water in our dams to be able to switch on the water all over again, which will take months. So it's hugely in our interests to stave off day zero, and that's what the entire city is convulsed doing at the moment. There are two things that have everybody in a complete panic. One is drinking water, and the second is flushing water. And an enormous amount of middle-class South Africans have suddenly woken up to the reality just of how much water a single flush takes. Some of the older toilets, you know, you're wasting up to 20 liters per flush. The modern ones take between 5 and 9 liters. That's a lot of water. Remember, we're allowed 25 a day. Now, if your flush, your daily flush, is taking 9 liters and you've got to leave at least 2 for drinking, you begin to see the enormity of the problem, and people are panicked. There are two things that make people unbelievably anxious. The thought that they may actually not be able to flush their shit, and the fact that they might actually start dehydrating. We're all now wearing our clothes until they literally climb off our bodies and run away and huddle in a corner. I wear the same outfit over and over and over and over again. It is now a mark of virtue to go everywhere with dirty hair. So don't come here and think that you will be able to step out the room pristine with your hair freshly washed or freshened every single day.
Cape Town is a city with extreme differences between the well-off and the poor. Having to leave their homes to fetch water at a central water station? Yeah, this has actually already been a daily task for many of the city's residents.
We are talking about settlements where there is no running water. There is no water pipe into homes. There are no flush toilets. People get their water from standpipes. In other words, they almost live at day zero level anyway. They have to queue for water. They have to fetch it themselves in buckets. They have to haul it home. They have to store it and heat it themselves. It looks as if, and please God, may this be true, they will have to leave water supplies to South African's townships. Mostly extremely poor black citizens live. Those water supplies will have to remain uninterrupted. What day zero means for Cape Townians is that this is coming for all of us, including our often extraordinarily blithe, selfish, blind, helpless, and wasteful middle classes. I've never seen such a dramatic change or upheaval in the life of my fellow citizens ever before. And that is saying something. Capetonians are gripped by a sort of a mix of panic and roll up our sleeves and can do. There's an enormous amount of blaming and wailing and finger pointing and hand wringing. There's an enormous amount of people sticking their heads in the sand and saying, la, 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 this can never happen. They can't do it. They cannot possibly switch off our water. And then there are a lot of people saying, well, let's get stuck in and solve this problem.
In the midst of this upheaval, Helen is already seeing beautiful examples of people looking after each other.
People who are saying, I've got a well. My tanks are set up to my gutters. I can harvest rainwater. Who is nearby that is vulnerable, that does not have these resources? How can I share with them? And that is truly amazing. We're seeing a return of the street committees that used to be so active under apartheid. And of course, things like social media and WhatsApp and cell phone technology has made it much easier for people to connect, especially with the elderly, the frail, single parents, people struggling alone with small children at home. People are sort of trying to identify who their neighbors are, who's vulnerable, who will need help on day zero, who can I share my water with now, which is what people like myself are doing to take strain off the grid.
Many poorer people in the townships without running water in their homes actually spend a lot of time in middle-class homes. They are the domestic workers and gardeners. I imagine they have valuable information to share about water conservation. They are experts at living within 25 liters of water per day.
If people thought there was going to be this wonderful sort of kumbaya moment where domestic workers and gardeners were able to say to their white middle-class employers, you poor things, let us show you how to do it. We know how to do it. Let us help you. Let's sort of share information. What's actually happening is that that requires such a profound disruption of the employer-employee relationship, which itself is further complicated by class stratification, which itself is further complicated by racial history, that those conversations are not taking place. And in fact, if you think about it, a domestic worker coming to work the home of a middle-class employer, she has to do all her own domestic work at home with water she has to haul and harvest and heat. Now she shows up at her employer's home. It's a relief for her to have hot water come flooding out of a tap. She doesn't want to hand wash her employer's laundry. She wants to chuck it in the machine and hit a nice convenient dial. So the last thing that woman wants is for her already difficult working life, her double shift doing housework in somebody else's home and her own home, to become more difficult, more challenging. It's all very well saying, yes, we're going to change all of our laundry and cleaning habits, and we're going to do this, we're going to do that. If you simply pass the extra burden of the labor onto already overburdened domestic workers, you know, it's not as simple or as wholesome as it might seem. A lot of domestic workers that I know are resisting sort of water-wise changes because it makes their lives more difficult. And I can only speak from what I see on social media, which is a great deal of sardonic laughter at Whitey's expense. And serve us bloody well right. people are saying, you mean you people don't know how to have a bucket bath? Somebody posted a photograph of themselves, just their feet in a bucket bath, you know, in a bucket of clean water. And she posted it on Twitter, and sort of the South African equivalent of Black Twitter fell about laughing, saying, doesn't she know that you put your feet in last after you've washed everything else?
We will get back to Helen in a moment, but I want to bring in another Capetonian, Judy Abram. She chatted with me from her office where she works on funding industrial development projects throughout South Africa. As most people know, race plays a significant role in South African history and society. Whites are the minority in South Africa. Up until the end of apartheid, the white minority ruled the country. Today, they still own many of the businesses and have significantly more wealth than the majority of black South Africans. As someone who is part of the majority population, I wanted to hear what Judy has to say. Like most people living in a drought, she first updated me on the weather and on her efforts at water conservation.
I think the first bit of rain, according to the weather forecast, is going to be summer rain on Friday and Saturday in Cape Town. But, I mean, we've had this off and on, and it's basically such a light drizzle for about 2 minutes. Everyone laughs at me when I was sitting in my study working. I said, oh my goodness, it's raining, and I ran to the bathroom, grabbed my shampoo and my towel, and I was going to go outside and wash. And have a shower by the time I got inside, and it stopped.
Judy recognizes just how serious a water shortage like this is. She believes World War III will likely be fought over water. In this case, a fight that could have been avoided.
Water, unfortunately, is not something that one can do without. And here I blame the government, irrespective of climate change, one's got to find mitigants as to how you actually manage this. It's a resource, it's a life-threatening resource if not provided. And national government has to provide, that's their responsibility. My fear is that even with desalinization, etc., I don't believe the powers that be that is required constitutionally to ensure that this resource is there has really partnered with people that can give the best solutions and proposals for how do we manage this resource, looking at desalination, alternate sources of water, and how do we do that. The municipality and the government is really demonstrating solution-driven. Yes, we can't make it rain if it's climate change, but what about our current infrastructure there? What can we do that when it does rain, we've actually maximized the amount of water that we get and how we manage it? Yeah.
In a city with so much imbalance of wealth and privilege, Judy thinks initially many black South Africans are better prepared for day zero. There's a white Afrikaans saying that black South Africans have adopted and adapted.
I'll translate it into English. It says, a farmer always makes a plan. Boer maak 'n plan. And we always say, black people were born with a plan. So it's interesting to see how people have turned this around, that their resources, the resourcefulness that they've got is actually contagious. And you pick that up at the water spots where you go and fetch your spring water.
Unfortunately, because of multiple technical difficulties, we couldn't talk for long. But Judy shared with me one of the hopes she is holding out during this crisis.
My hope is that the momentum of awareness that we've had will be maintained, and people really will not, after the first bout of rain and all these announcements of day zero being moved out, that it doesn't become the sense of, oh well, we've passed that hurdle, so we're back to our bad ways, or our ways of not really looking after the resource. So that's my hope.
Back to Helen Moffat. Helen recognizes the role climate change plays in the current water crisis in Cape Town. She's also critical of fellow white middle-class South Africans and the ways they have contributed to it.
Given how the middle-class South Africans have behaved in the last, really, for the whole of the 20th century, we have fouled our own nest as much as anybody else. We were not some indigenous utopian climate paradise. that got fouled up by you. We also drive cars, and we waste water to an extent that absolutely horrifies me as somebody who grew up in an arid part of the country as a child and was utterly dependent on river, dam, and borehole water, and knew what it was like to have a borehole run out. So I grew up knowing that water was scarce and a precious resource. You would never think that that was a reality for most middle-class South African. We've mimicked whole-scale patterns of water consumption from North America and Europe, from countries that have snow and ample precipitation. So, for example, we have adopted this thing that was unheard of when I was a child, ensuite bathrooms. Every bedroom must have its own bathroom. This is insane. 10 years ago, everybody started putting spa baths in their bathrooms. This is demented. Then we started putting pools and plunge pools into every single backyard. When I was a child, a pool was a rare thing. Only a very, very wealthy friend, you know, sort of in the neighborhood would have a pool. Now, if you do any aerial shot, any drone or Google shot of any middle-class South African suburb, and every second house has a pool, you know, our children are going to say to us, what? You ran potable water into huge fiberglass holes in your gardens so that you could loll around in them, you could swim in them. So we are as much to blame, I reckon, as anybody else. The water crisis has not just been caused by climate change, although that's a huge part of it. It has also been caused in Cape Town by profligate and wasteful water use.
In addition, like Judy mentioned, the local and national government needed to do more to respond to the coming crisis. She sees the Cape Town water crisis as a warning to the world.
Now, we were told in 1998, officially, that we would run out of water in 2015. Did we do anything about it? The hell we did. We were told again, it was major headlines in all of the newspapers in 2001 by the city's own advisory boards. Cape Town will run out of water in about 2015. Did we listen? Hell no. Well, those same sorts of advisory bodies are telling Istanbul, for example, that they are going to run out of water in 2030. When somebody says your city will run out of water in 5 to 10 to 15 to 20 years' time, believe them and do something proactive about it now. So when I hear Istanbul is going to run out of water in 2030, London is going to run out of water in 2040, I don't think, oh, that's still 20 years ago. I don't need to worry about it. Install rain harvesting devices and water wise devices. Get those systems up and running. Legislation takes a long time to write. Water resilience takes a long time to build.
Cape Town did not prepare, and the crisis is now upon them. Helen already sees the potential for trouble for the most vulnerable.
The ugly is seeing people who are immediately profiteering, people who are going to things like natural springs and boreholes and wells and sucking up the water out of them, which, by the way, is strictly illegal. Sucking them up into tanks and then sort of driving around selling that water to people who are now desperately stockpiling water against day zero. So the ugly is seeing people squabbling, getting into fisticuffs in queues for bottled water at stores, at supermarkets, seeing people sort of barging and bullying in queues at springs. We're seeing water theft from people's rain tanks. Water suddenly has a street value. So at the moment, 50 liters of water has the same street fence value as a used cell phone. I don't want to be doomsdayer, and I'm trying to be a Pollyanna and sort of keep calm and carry on. And I see this as an opportunity for greater social cohesion and sharing. But I am worried about the prospects of violence. Desperate people and thirsty people are more likely to become violent. We have a powder keg of a history that we're all sitting on. All sorts of fault lines and unhealed wounds could come to the fore. South African women, the fact that many of them have to collect water has always put them at a greater risk of sexual assault, violence, Just plain assault. I mean, now, instead of being robbed of their cell phones and their meager income the way home from collecting water, they're going to have their water stolen. That's a very harsh reality. Then there's going to be people who prey on the vulnerable. You know, as I said in one of my very early blogs, you know, what happens when you've got Auntie Mavis who can't drive a car, who lives in a sort of very modest suburb. She has asthma and she's thirsty and she's desperate. And a likely looking lad knocks at her door, flashes a badge in her face and says, give me your ID book and your water containers and R100 and I'll go fetch water for you. And disappears and is never seen ever again. And then Auntie Mavis is even worse off. So I worry about that. And I think that it's going to take considerable amount of social cohesion and an open commitment to stepping up and looking out for and after the vulnerable to protect against that sort of behavior.
We see it over and over. A crisis brings out the worst and the best in people. Fear over limited resources can provoke selfish and even violent actions. Still, time and again, many people have almost instinctively discovered ways of caring for each other. And Helen sees this as a unique opportunity to model something that younger people will remember for the rest of their lives on this changing planet.
I think that if our kids see us saying, right, okay, we got ourselves into this mess. Let's roll up our sleeves and literally take care of our own shit. And start being proactive, getting out the power tools, installing the pressure pumps, looking up water-wise meals online, thinking about ways to reuse water, sharing bathtub water, like I did as a little girl. Also, we can model community methods where you say the community you belong to is important. Its needs and its goals and its vulnerabilities are as important as those of our own little world, our own little kingdom, our own family. If our kids see us saying, okay, we have to look after the little old lady who lives down the road, we have to go and adopt that little non-profit or that little nursery school or that little retirement village down the road, they're going to grow up with a much, much better sense of compassion, empathy and understanding, but they're going to grow up much less helpless. They're going to grow up seeing, oh, when confronted with problems, we can solve them. We can be proactive. We don't have to sit around helplessly like cuckoos in the nest with our great big greedy beaks open, hoping that federal governments or state governments or local municipalities or somebody will come along and take care of us.
As we experience these effects of climate change, and as we work to radically reduce our pollution, everybody has a part to play. Individuals, households, communities, businesses, and government, large and small. Access to safe and affordable water may be one of the biggest challenges we face over the next few decades. What was once fiction or scientific projection is now reality. No doubt you will hear a lot more about this water crisis over the next few months. To dig deeper, I have links to all of my guests. You can find the show notes over on the episode blog at citizensclimate.org. Just look for the blog at citizensclimate.org. That's all the time we have, and I have so many great responses to the puzzler that I'll share next month. Special thanks to my guests, Helen Moffitt and Judy Abrams. Many thanks to Patrick Dowling, Patricia Jean Smith, Kathy Orlando, and Glenn Retiff. There are now more places than ever to listen to Citizens Climate Radio. Many listen through the Citizens Climate Lobby channel on Podbean, iTunes, and other podcast providers. The show also has its very own feed. Just search for Citizens Climate Radio on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Player FM, and TuneIn. you can also listen at northernspirit.org. Feel free to email me your suggestions, requests, and general greetings. Just send those to radio@citizensclimate.org. We're also on Twitter and Facebook. Visit citizensclimatelobby.org/blog to see info about our puzzler and find links to our guests. Citizens Climate Radio is a project of Citizens Climate Education.